Hey everyone, welcome back to season 2 of Gateway Episodes. I am your host, Derek McDuff, here to talk about some more mini/limited series for this season. Joining me today from the Album Concept Hour is Brad LeBaron, who introduced me to the show, The Tenth Kingdom. How's it going, Brad?
Hey, how's it going? I'm doing pretty good. Thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for being on the podcast last night. Well, not for the listeners, maybe, but we did ours back to back.
Recording back to back nights. So like Brad was saying. I got to be on the show. We talked about Hot Fuss and The Killers, and you know, I nerded out about that. That's one of the few bands I actually know a lot about.
We really broke it down.
thank you.
Yeah.
I was like, if I'm going to talk about some album, it might as well be Hot Fuss, because I actually know a few things about it.
Yeah.
But that was really fun. But yeah, so that will be, it's going to take me a while to edit all the episodes and stuff for this one, so it'll be in the past, but definitely go back and listen to that episode, and whatever episodes are new in whatever future time you people are listening to on your hoverboards and whatnot.
It will have come out early March. When it came out in the past.
If you can remember that far back.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah. These years are longer these days, so who knows.
Yep. Brad, I kind of reached out to him and we agreed to be on each other's shows, and I was asking him for a show to introduce me to, or specifically a mini series, because that's what I'm doing with this season. And you recommended The Tenth Kingdom, which is a show that I was thinking about it, and I was like, I don't think I ever had heard of the show. Yeah. Maybe I had, but like when I saw the theme song, I was like, I've definitely seen the theme song. Like, I feel like that was like really kind of everywhere somehow, at least, just the theme song was.
It is a killer theme song.
Intro
thing in general.
But why don't you, you know, so for the people who just so everyone knows, this is a 5-episode miniseries, sometimes described as 10, but it did air on 5 nights.
I don't know why some describe it as 10, but considering there's no names to the episodes, I guess that's not, that was kind of on the back burner, the structure or whatever.
Yeah, because it did air over 5 nights when it was originally on, and it was, I guess, kind of broken up. And I can, watching this episode, I can see where there's definitely a split between the first hour and the second hour, or the first 45 minutes and the second 45 minutes.
Some of them more clear than others, you know. Mm-hmm, but there's a it just keeps going, you know. Yeah,
but so the episode that we watched for this was episode 7 and 8.
You were correct.
Okay.
I was going to say no, but you're correct. 7 and 8, which would be 4 if you were watching it. It's the fourth night of the show. Did you watch, I was going to ask before we got into this, did you watch any like miniseries like this that came out in the 90s, like this style of miniseries?
We kind of thought a little bit that I was really, really, and it was one you recommended to me possibly doing, but I was like, oh, I'm very familiar with this.
The other one.
It was Merlin, which is the fucking shit. Like, I loved some Merlin.
It is, so good.
You've got Sam Neill being a badass mad, like, he's basically like if Sam Neill was like Gandalf almost. Like, it's so fucking
dude,
cool.
Right?
And I remember like it being a kid and just like small, I guess spoilers for a miniseries from the mid 90s, but like ends with everyone just like, we're just gonna forget Morgan Le Fay. It's such a literary ending, and it blew my 6-year-old mind. I was like, what? It doesn't have to end in a big Power Rangers style fight. It can just be this like thing where they just walk away, and I was like, I don't know. I used to rewatch it over and over and over.
I constantly think about that moment in Merlin, by the way. That is seriously one of my favorite endings as well. It's just brilliant for any like series that has a lot of war and bloodshed, and that's what you would you'd expect the big action climax. But it's like, no, we're just gonna ignore you and your shitty behavior, and we're gonna move on with our lives. And I was like, huh, that's actually how we should deal with a lot of people in this world sometimes. Right? You know,
just like if we all forgot certain people,
we would just maybe not pay attention to certain people. But yeah, it was very impactful for me too. I feel like Merlin's definitely the goat of like TV miniseries in the 90s. Like, it's this one though is a very different animal than Merlin.
Merlin too is, it's a lot shorter. Merlin is basically like, I didn't know it wasn't a movie as a kid because it just felt like a movie because it was only two parts. Whereas this is like 10 parts, so it's essentially like almost 10 hours long or whatever, you know? So very different.
Yeah, long one.
Yeah. Because I was actually, I've got all the miniseries I have planned out that I'm going to cover, and this one is either the longest or the second longest, and I kind of want to get into more of that and how miniseries have kind of changed over the years and what they were then and what they are now. But before we get to any of that too much into the weeds there, because I want to circle back, why don't we talk about specifically the Tenth Kingdom and what about it you love and what about it you wanted me to get into?
Well, first of all, I have to point out that the Tenth Kingdom is a little bit of a misnomer, considering that in the story, the Tenth Kingdom is New York. Like, there's the Nine Kingdoms of fairy tale land, and then New York and New York has little to do with the plot, but the reason I chose, are you asking why I chose this episode or this series?
Well, yeah, let's say the series first and then this episode. Yeah,
well, this series first of all was really important in my family home. My sister had the tape after we watched it on TV, my sister Katie, we watched this a bunch on VHS. We wore out this tape. It was just the perfect level of jokes and, you know, saucy sexual stuff, but not too sexual, you know, that the whole family could kind of enjoy it. And it takes this very interesting approach to fairy tale stories, which is taking kind of the kind of Narnia kind of turn, where like it several hundred years have passed from the, you know, time that started and the story that you're watching started. So there's all these references to these old stories, but it's actually it's a completely new story on its own right. So it was just a really cool, interesting, captivating world, and they clearly had a pretty big budget for this TV movie thing. I haven't watched it in a long time, but I think it ages pretty okay. There's a few things that are, you know, a little aged, but for the most part, I think that it does pretty well.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think there was only a couple moments where I was like, for like a 90s TV budget, it looks, I guess it came out 2000, they shot it in the 90s, but like for TV budget, it looks really impressive. The only thing that like took me out of a little in terms of like, there was a lot of sound effects that I feel like would not exist in a show today, like where the guy hits his head on a sign, it's like, and it was like a cartoon sound almost, and I was like,
dated,
but other than that
well, yeah, there's a few moments where it gets like all weird slapsticky, you know. Like the three troll characters are basically like the Three Stooges, and there's a lot of those stock noises you're talking about. But yeah, it does rides the line between a lot of different tones. You know, it's doing a lot. It is this world is trying to do a lot.
And succeeding, I think, for the most part.
Yeah, yeah. It's got some, you know, people that you know. If you're a 90s kid, John Larroquette, I think is how it's pronounced. Was in a lot of stuff back then, you know, in a lot
all
of...
All I know him is from, there's a bit in Futurama where, like, Bender digs up a graveyard on the moon. He's like, no one can say that. I don't own John Larroquette's spine. And that's, like, all I know from
Yeah, I remember him being in a lot of things, although none of them are very clear, except for this one.
Yeah.
Like he seems so, so familiar. Mm-hmm. But he's just one of those faces in the 90s that just was in a lot of sitcoms and stuff. And then you have Diane West as Queen Christine. We find out her name is in this episode. But the stepmother. And then,
a cliffhanger at the end there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So not to get too far ahead, but one of the ways I described this episode is that it's a bit of the Empire Strikes Back of the 10th Kingdom. And I guess we shouldn't get into why exactly, right? Should we save the
Yeah, let's hold off on that for a sec, cuz let's go over the cast. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to get into like the main characters for this?
Yeah, well, there's
I was going to ask actually of you, like, what was your impression of the like three main human leads? There's a dog that talks that's actually different. Yeah. But there's the three human leads, Wolf, Tony, and Virginia, I forgot where it is, but yeah. What did you think of them?
I was really, so I thought Wolf was the character that I knew his actor because it's Scott Cohn, who would go on to be a recurring character on Gilmore Girls, who is really bad at proposals. Like he,
okay.
Yeah.
So he did do other stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all I knew him from, really. Like, I've seen him pop up and stuff, but like for me, I'm like, oh, that's Max Bedia from the Gilmore Girls. Like I know him really well from that. One of Lorelai's main love interests. Probably the second most important one, other than Luke. Huh. But
weird, because he does look like he could be related to Jesse, maybe.
Huh. So well, but yeah, he. So that's what I knew him from. And then I didn't really know the main. The protagonist, either. I hadn't seen her really in everything. I really liked her character. I thought she was just kind of that plucky, you know, just kind of like hero, like, you know, the hero's journey type character who's, you know, almost Alice in Wonderland-esque, just kind of like she's fallen into this other world.
Definitely.
And kind of has to go. And her dad is not bumbling, but he's kind of an idiot, like, especially when he smashes the mirror and stuff like that. Her performance was really good. Really captivating character. I thought Wolf was a creep. It was just like kind of coming in there.
Yes.
Like where he's as just like,
As far as how the show ages, that's the part that ages the poorest is his entire character.
He just seems like a scumbag. He's just like, oh yeah, I'm going to like spend all this money to get her to marry me. And like, I don't want her to leave. I'm going to like entrap her.
Okay. So the scumbag thing came through just in this episode. I'm glad.
Yeah. I have a feeling like there'll be more context.
I was about to say, this is maybe some of the least scumbaggy behavior up to this point. He is kind of a, he's both a literal predator because he is a wolf. Mm-hmm. And a sexual predator who, well, let's say the series pretends that he is a you know, reforming sexual predator. So, there's a lot of, especially the first couple of episodes, he is just like getting in her personal space way too often.
That was such a thing in the like the 90s, just like, sexual abuse, isn't it charming? And you're like, no.
Yeah, like they always portrayed like what is we now consider sexual abuse as just flirting and stuff. And it's like, everyone just getting up in people in each other's physical space, like without any sort of like hint or asking, you know, but I mean, I guess in this context, it does help that he's a literal wolf or whatever. But I don't know. They're a little inconsistent with that because in this very episode, there is a full moon. And the previous episode to this, the like entire plot revolved around the fact that a full moon was happening and he couldn't control his urges.
Okay.
So like they kind of just have that plot point and then just ignore it completely next episode. So it's mostly consistent this show, except for every now and again, like that's because they prominently show the moon in this episode, mm-hmm. like, you know, in a big, you know, I guess CGI masterpiece of the time. what do you think of the special effects?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, speaking of CGI masterpieces and special effects, one thing that I did not enjoy about this episode, although I think that it was intentionally annoying, was that fucking ring. I hated that ring goddamn much. I was just like, shut the fuck up, ring. Like, you spent 7,000 gold pieces or whatever on this, and then it's something that's like a random weird pet peeve of mine when he just like fucking threw it into like, it's like people throwing engagement rings into a body of water. And because it happens in The Constant and Lost, and that was like that's literally the only moment of that episode that I just don't absolutely
love. Wow, that happens in The Constant here. Too?
Yeah, like Desmond. Weird. When he can't, maybe it's not, no, it's not The Constant. I think it's Flashes Before Your Eyes. It's a Desmond episode.
Okay, yeah. Those are always good.
Yeah, Desmond chucks it in after he's going to get ready to propose to Penny, and then the time-traveling ladies, or not the, you know.
Now, here's my question for you. Mm-hmm. Is there a payoff for that?
For the ring?
For him throwing the ring?
No. Is there a payoff? No,
I will tell you.
Okay.
There is a payoff, as dumb as it seems.
Okay.
And the payoff is just as dumb as the execution of him throwing the ring. But
I was like, he's got it insured. The guy who sold it to him said there's a guarantee, a love guarantee. And I was like, get that 7,000 gold back, man.
Speaking of which, I want to talk about that guy for a second, actually. In the context of this show, he kind of, that scene really represents kind of the kind of line they're drawing between the real world and this fantasy world. It's this clock shop with all these magical clocks, and it's, you know, he's a shopkeeper, he has clocks, he has jewels, and before the scene starts, one of the clocks like goes a few seconds later than the rest of them, and then without saying anything, he like picks up the clock, takes it in back, and then you hear this like little scream and what is clearly a shotgun noise, like shooting this clock. And like up to this point, there have been zero guns in the show. Like there has been you know, no evidence that there are guns in this world. But it kind of flippantly like switches between like real world stuff and like the, you know, fairy tale stuff really well, I think.
Yeah. And then kind of while we're still talking about the cast, real fast, one other member I wanted to mention of the cast is Rutger Hauer is so fucking sinister in this.
Dude,
he is just like, he's just kind of creeping around with that cool hat. He's like, I'm going to buy this mirror. I'm going to chase you up this mountain. I'm like, go away, Rutger. Like, he's so fucking scary. Like, it seems like it's like, all these people, they're good TV actors, but they're TV actors. And you have Rutger Hauer, who is like a movie. This is like, dude was in fucking Blade Runner. Like, oh my God.
Yeah, he is easily the most scary and, you know, just a diabolical character in this whole thing. He slaughters people mercilessly several times, like a group of people, because he's got this gun, well, this crossbow, that every time he shoots it, it has to hit a heart of a living creature. So, like, he is just set up from the get-go to be, you know, your Terminator character or Jason for this story. But, Rutger fucking Hauer, just out of nowhere in this show.
And then Ed O'Neill's in this shit as, like, because I didn't notice him at first.
He's saw, a lot
like,
of makeup.
In the credits, and then I was like seeing this like troll guy, and he says something like, "Wow!" I'm like, "Wait a minute, is that my?" I think I said it like, "Is that fucking Ed O'Neill?" Like, and I was like, "Yep, that's him." And it's like, right there where it was like, I think this is after Married with Children, but it's before Modern Family, so it's like, what was he doing in that time? Just putting on a lot of makeup and doing this crazy character in this, you know, movie or miniseries. So
Behind the scenes, he references his Married with Children character, and he definitely looks more like the Married with Children Ed O'Neill. They're wearing, like, for the trolls, they're wearing like Star Trek level prosthetics on their heads to make their, you know, giant noses and foreheads and weird hair stuff coming down. But yeah, great job on the makeup in general. Like, you know, without like the help of like a lot of CGI for that.
Yeah, this is definitely, it's interesting because this is the era where, you know, they did some stuff with CGI, as we kind of mentioned, but it wasn't, they reliant on it because it wasn't good enough to use a lot of CGI. They had to use it sparingly. So they had to rely on practical effects, which is always really nice. But also I wanted to kind of get to why this episode, because it's interesting when I, you know, tell people about this show, a lot of times they'll give like the first or second episode or something. Whereas this is, you know, with it being, you know, out of the five episodes, this is the fourth episode. This is like the end, you know, this is the penultimate episode.
Yeah.
So why did you choose this one? I mean, we touched on that it's Empire Strikes Back, but like, you know, this being a jumping off point.
Yeah. So I was thinking at first, you know, with something that's this weird, the first episode's probably the best place to start. But like, honestly, like, I don't know, there's a lot of setup in the first episode and there's some interesting bits, but like, I feel like it's about, you know, not until later in this show you kind of get some more of the character development. By this point, the three know each other pretty well and they're interacting pretty well. But also I think that it just it's a real turning point in the story. So I think it's probably a good episode to hook someone if they want to, you know, watch the rest of it. Although I'll say, I mean, it's all pretty entertaining. So you can mostly, this is one of those things I think you can mostly start anywhere. But yeah. If you really like are maybe someone that's younger and is cringes at some of that like older special effects or stuff, then, you know, maybe, you know, this will pique your interest. Because like you were saying earlier, there's a really good, clear kind of a hero's journey happening with Virginia. Like, she starts off as like an unknown, you know, she's a waitress. Her mom left her and her dad when she was young. And her dad is just a, you know, single dad janitor trying to make, you know, the bills and stuff. Then Wolf shows up and turns everything upside down. I forget the inciting incident that starts off all this shit, but the mirror is very important. We should mention that's the mirrors in general in this universe, because that's kind of how it comes to be. There's this mirror that goes to Central Park in New York and back. That's about the extent they get into that part of the story. They don't seem to care about any other part of Earth besides Central Park and New York. So before you even start, don't ask. There's no there's no resolution there. Okay. Which bothered me when I was younger. Like, why were only in New York for like a day? Eventually, you know, she has this, you know, journey. She's got, you know, this trying to be reformed sexual predator that's advancing on her constantly. The world is very hostile. The world is a very, very hostile place in this world. And every episode they're kind of going through kind of a late, like, grandkids of Little Bo Peep or Red Riding Hood and visiting different places. And then it culminates, her journey culminates in, well, I guess probably the next episode, but this is where it's kind of like she goes from being like, you know, the main character that has been swept into this journey just because of these series of events to becoming someone that's like in it for themselves and knows that they are kind of the hero of the story. So, yeah, this is where she starts to kind of come into her own, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. She definitely seems like it, like about halfway through, so probably between episodes, you know, the episodes that aired during the night, she kind of flips the switch and becomes a much more active protagonist. Whereas, like, in the first one, she's like, okay, let's all just try and get this money back. Is my dad doing it? Is Wolf doing it? You know? Uh-huh. And then she's like, no, like, we're going to go to the Dwarf Mountain. I'm going to go down the slide with the dog and do the thing. So, you know, I feel that that came through for sure. And you get enough, like, from context without having seen the first four episodes. I get these character relationships. I get what this world is. Okay. It's kind of like, you know, this fairy tale esque world, but it's like a darker take on it. And it's like years later, you have allusions to like Snow White and all these characters, which is really ahead of its time. Cause I think that's a thing that a lot of, especially like teen fiction is doing nowadays. Uh-huh, you have all these like
reimaginings.
Like, you know, you always would get stuff like Wicked and stuff like, you know, that, and all these things that would come out.
Twilight.
It feels like it's ahead of Twilight or, well, I mean, more just kind of like stuff that's like specifically like takes on like classic fairy tales or classic, you know, stories that are kind of like, what if it's a little bit darker, you know, like what if Snow White died and she's got a tomb and you know, and her grandson is like a prince and he's a dog now. And
there's a lot of exposition in this episode too, which is nice. Like that you get to actually see Snow White. Like people have been alluding to Snow White a lot throughout the show. They're at Snow White's cottage in a previous episode. We should talk about Snow White for a second, because this is probably, I feel like that scene is like maybe the most important scene in the episode, in the, I don't know if the show or the episode, but I just wanted to say, just to start off, it's very much a Luke Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi type like discussion. And
like when he's on Dagobah and he sees his Force ghost.
For me, I cannot, you know, think of anything but that with this scene, because, well, it's kind of, well, I guess she's kind of Yoda and Obi-Wan, if you will, because there's one part after she kind of gives her, you know, a pep talk and she gives her like a wish or something to which she uses to get rid of her dad's bad luck, because mirrors give you bad luck in this universe, which is another plot. But then at some point, she says, do not think, become. And I can't quite remember the context, but it seemed very much to me like for a moment she's trying to do a do or do not, there is no try kind of line.
Yeah, you know? Now that you say that, I'm like, okay, that's a vibe right there. It's a Yoda vibe for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But she's like classic Snow White too. Like she's... Like, we should emphasize, like, everyone is, like, they're kind of classic fairy tale costumes, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Just, they're good costumes. Great costuming in this whole thing.
Yeah, really good costume design in this, for sure.
Yeah. But, but she's, you know, she gives our hero a magic mirror thing, gives her a pep talk. Tells her some vague thing about how the mirror will show you what you want to see and what you don't. And then you know, she leaves in her Rutger Hauer is about to murder her dad in cold blood, and she hits him on the head with a torch and he's out cold. It's crazy. She's the only one that seems to be able to stop him, and mostly by just bricking him in the head without when he's not looking. But we should also mention there's a lot of villains to get through in this, so I'll just briefly mention there's Ed O'Neill, who gets murked in this episode.
That was not expected. That caught me by surprise,
right? Like some fucking Red Wedding shit in this episode. Like the person she gets killed by is like the real head honcho of this, which is Queen Christine, who was it was the stepmother of Wendell or something. They refer to her as stepmother up to this point, mm-hmm. Vaguely. And she was imprisoned long ago, and she was let out in the first episode. She's got all these big plans, and ends up having to kill the troll's dad, which I gotta say, real sad, because when his kids find out about it, they are broken up about it. One troll is openly cutting himself while
they
are walking.
I saw that shit. I was like, damn.
I was like, whoa, dude. Like, pump the brakes, director. Holy shit. I think they thought maybe it was a comedy beat, but it was like, I don't know.
Like, that's one part that also has not aged super well, just like self-harm.
Yeah. Flipping self-harm. He's just carving giant fucking, but yeah, his dad died. So she's the queen, is the head honcho. She murdered the other, you know, kind of lesser bad that was just kind of he's kind of like a Game of Thrones character, the Edo.
Well, I kind of love that trope too of like there's the bad, the like the kind of like, okay, we've got the second and ancillary, I can't pronounce that word, bad, and then you've got like the big bad, and the big bad is just like fucking takes out like the secondary bad guy, and you're like, oh shit, this guy is for real. Like, this main bad guy real. Is for fucking real. Like, because you I love that when you have all these different sides. It's like, okay, what's gonna happen? Are they gonna team up? No, you just took him out. Like, I was like, that was fucking, that was intense. Yeah. That was rad.
It was a real, like, especially when I saw it as a kid or whatever. It was like fucking mind blowing. And they're like, later in the episode, they're like she takes his head off, and like they're they're like flashing his head around on next to the carriage to show everyone that the Troll King's dead, and real brutal stuff for television of the 90s. Like, it was a little shocking, honestly. But yeah, so she is the big bad, and she they explain more of this in the next episode. But she got power from the queen, the stepmother that poisoned Snow White, you know. She's like a dead body. You see her in the episode.
Quick scene of her.
So she is she's a bad guy. And between her and Rutger Hauer, there is so many deaths. Really, really bloody show. Considering all the fact that it's a fairy tale premise, it's very violent. All that though, to kind of lead up to the twist, which we should, is it okay to get to the
talk about the twist in this episode, because you know, it kind of, you know, it caught me off guard, you know, for sure.
They do not hint at it at all. So it's a really well done twist. But you find out after she gets the magic mirror, they get out of the Dragon Mountain with all the dwarves didn't really talk about, but
the Mines of Moria.
Rutger Hauer, I think you're led to believe that he just slaughtered all of those dwarves, but they never touch on it.
They don't mention any.
They don't really. He gets to the place where they're at, but like, they don't show the scene where he like negotiates with the dwarves or anything. So I don't know. they get out, and her and her dad, she says to it, "Who's the fairest of them all?" Which I thought was kind of a weird, way to get the result that they got. But they all of a sudden they see the queen, the big bad, and the dad's like, "Christine?" So he like knows the name, and he's like, "It's your mother. What's your mother doing there?" And like, you find out as the audience, they find out as the characters. It's like, it's the Empire Strikes Back, Luke and Vader moment for this year.
Yep. I am your mother.
That's part of the reason it's one of those series that has stuck with me through the years, because They didn't, just like in Star Wars, they didn't lead up to it in any way or hint at it in any way, or, you know, like there was, you know, you knew that he didn't have, she didn't have a mother, and you know, that was a part of her backstory, but I don't think anyone saw it coming.
Yeah, that was really cool. That was a really good, you know, moment. And, you know, I think that along with the whole rest of the episode, like you said, it was an episode that really kind of does a good job of hooking you in. And I will say, like, I am definitely hooked now. And I'm absolutely going to be stepping through the gateway and watching this whole thing. Like, I'm going to watch all, like, 10 hours or whatever. Because this was, I love fantasy worlds, especially fantasy worlds that are kind of like magical realism, where it is kind of like, oh, there is some realness here that is, you know, I kind of like when it's like that secondary connect world, like it's, you know, there is a portal to the real world. So some of our actual world is spilling through into this fantasy and you're getting some back and forth of that. I was really digging that. I'm really excited to go back and see, you know, what all led up to this, and then kind of rewatch this episode with that context, and then finally get to go and see the, like, how it ends. So I'm very stoked that this was your pick from me.
Yeah, no, thanks. It's I'm glad to be talking about it. I didn't think I'd ever get a chance to talk about this show. So this has been a nice opportunity. And shout out to my sister Katie, you know, who's gonna probably listen to this. I hope we talked about the things that that you loved about 10th Kingdom as well. Such a great time. I didn't, you know, regret any of the time I spent rewatching it, you know.
It's an absolute, like, blast, and just, you know, interesting characters, and it does feel like, and I kind of hinted towards this at the beginning of the episode, this kind of mini series, that this long epic that doesn't really get made anymore.
Yeah.
At least not in this form. And one thing that I was kind of noticing when I was, like, looking at all the series that I've decided to cover, half of them were are my picks, and half of them were suggested to me. And I looked at it, and it just happened to be that they were mostly in two separate 2-year stretches or 3-year stretches. And I was thinking about, like, wow, that's a weird coincidence, but I don't think it's actually a coincidence. I think there is a really big reason for that. Yeah, and the two stretches are the stretch between 98 and 2001, and then 2019 and 2021. And I was thinking about why that is, and I think it's because if you look at kind of like the life cycle of the miniseries, like they get started in kind of the 80s. They're this really big thing. They're these big events, you know, and you can only, like, watch them like one night. So you have to watch them. And before VCRs are really prevalent, and you have these ones like Roots and like It's, and they're these events that everyone watches, then you go and talk about for the next day, and they just kind of consume the culture. And then they kind of, you know, they do, you get some more of those in the 90s with Merlin and this, obviously. But then they start to fall off, and I think there's a few reasons for that. One is that you have VHSs by the 90s, and people can just kind of record them and watch them, so they're less of events. But the other really big reason I think of is because TV was really changing a lot, and it has by now completely changed.
Completely different landscape.
Back then, TV was very episodic. It was just kind of stories that never really went, like, they kind of just continued and continued and continued until they ran out of gas. Whereas miniseries was like, okay, this is an option for us to tell a story on TV that has a definitive beginning, middle, and end. And miniseries really utilize that well. And, you know, this is kind of, you know, the beginning of the end here, this episode. And,
Well, I was going to say one thing, when I was doing some research for this, in the behind the scenes, they mentioned how the Gulliver's Travels that came out.
Yeah, I remember that
with
one.
Ted Danson came out like a few years prior. And someone on you know, the interview was saying that it was a literary TV movies, they were calling them.
Yeah, there was a lot of, like, a Troy one, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, there was like, and they a lot of, you know, the ones that they mentioned ended up being like, you know, education material for, you know, if you're in high school, you know, like the Gulliver's Travels one's a great, you know, visual representation of it. But yeah, the idea of like actually, you know, I mean, I guess it's kind of what, you know, this really, I guess, reminded me of Game of Thrones most of all. Although, you know, obviously we all know Game of Thrones wasn't finished. So there's the whole, like, you know, it goes in a different direction thing. But yeah, the real beauty of any miniseries is that definitive ending. Because like there's that like catharsis that comes with an, you know, an actual closing of the book and like those characters that you've kind of fallen in love with over a certain period of time. You know,
absolutely. Like, you could not be more right. And for so long, TV didn't have that, to the point where, like, look at Gilligan's Island, and they just never got off the island because they just kept it wanting to renew it and renew it.
Yeah.
But then with like the advent and the rise of like quote unquote prestige TV in the early mid 2000s, with you know, shows like Lost and Breaking Bad and The Sopranos and Game of Thrones, like you mentioned, these are all shows that are building to something, that have a definitive end date, you know, and I've kind of mentioned on this show before how Lost, like, you know, Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse were like, we want an ending to the show, and ABC was like, no, let's make more and more and more, but they're like, no, we have to close this book, we have to end this story, and you know, that's would be, you know, would be a miniseries thing, it wouldn't have been a TV thing, but nowadays, you know, like, TV is so serialized and it's not episodic at all.
Well, yeah, if it makes X amount of money, then you're almost, you know, secured for another season, regardless of whether it makes sense. Which is why I'm glad, like, a show like Watchmen, they have already said, like, they're not going to continue with it.
Yeah.
You know, like, that it was such a great story on its own, and they were like, oh, we're stepping away, that's it, that's it.
Yep, exactly. And, and it's, and, you know, I think that kind of speaks to why miniseries went away for a while. But then, you know, in, like I was saying, I have, like, the last five shows that I want to talk about are all limited series that, when it started to come back in this new form, which is these, like, streaming miniseries, like, these basically streamers kind of have revived this form where they're like, okay, we're going to, like, tell this limited story. It's going to be basically a season of TV, but, like, it's going to have a definitive story beginning, middle, and end. So, you know, like, the first episode of this season, we talked about the Queen's Gambit, which is, they're just kind of these prestigious, you get all these big name actors, you know, and kind of put them in a thing. Chernobyl's another one we're going to talk about. HBO kind of has always, it's funny because I've got HBO series from both eras, because they've always kind of been, you know, the big in terms of miniseries, but now that they're back in the streaming game, you know, they're like, okay, we're gonna, like, you know, we're gonna make these stories. So it's really interesting to see now the miniseries kind of, you know, that TV has become this other thing. All right, we're gonna do our own prestige thing, but instead of it being like three seasons, six seasons with a definitive end, it's still gonna be that one, here's the story, and it's, you know, like Queen's Gambit. That's another thing that's a literary adaptation, you know? So even Chernobyl is based on a book. So it's all these,
all good things are for these TV movies things.
So it's really interesting to see kind of the way that the ebb and flow of this, you know, storytelling form. So I'm interested to see, you know, we're at a really cool point in it now where it is coming back, and, you know, you don't have to rely on, okay, we've got to, like, they are still common events, but in a different way where it's like, okay, it's out now, but you don't have to be like, okay, we watched it tonight, we missed it, now we're never going to see it again, you know?
Yeah, it's like people are just talking about it for weeks, like, you have to see this, you really, really, you have to see this thing. And then eventually enough people tell you about it, and you're like, all right, I'll go see it.
Yes.
But so, that's a little bit different than the 90s, but love it.
Yeah, so it's really, I was thinking about that, those two kind of distinct eras of the slash miniseries a lot leading up to this.
Yeah, and I'd love to see more like this in even honestly a similar budget, you know, or you know, similar like special effects grade. I would be totally cool with it. It's just
Well, I mean, we're going to get the Lord of the Rings series, which, I mean, it's not technically a miniseries, but like they put like $1 billion or something in crazy like that into it. Like,
yeah, I mean, yeah, they've been working on that.
I don't know what that show's gonna be, but it's gonna be good. It's gonna, or it's gonna be look good at least. It's gonna be look incredible. Like,
yeah.
Made a lot of money into that show. So
yeah, I'm real curious, but definitely skeptical because it didn't seem like it needed to necessarily be done. But
yeah, I'm optimistically cautious. I guess I should say
optimistic.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. I've always wanted them to do the Dark Tower as a limited series.
That would be cool. Yeah.
They screwed that up big time in the movie.
Yeah, I know my co-host on my other show, Underrated, is like a real big Stephen King guy. So he's all about like the Dark Tower. And, you know, I mean, I would love to see like Lindelof do it because he's a really, really big Dark Tower, like he loves Stephen King, which is obvious. If you watch Lost, you can see the definitely, like, there's a character named the Man in Black on Lost, you know.
That's true. Yeah
But yeah, that would be like, I could see HBO or somebody doing that, you know.
One day I would love to see it, because I mean, if done correctly, it'd be really, really amazing.
Yeah. One other one we talked about was we talked about the 2002 movie Count of Monte Cristo, and we were like, this is a good movie, but if it got made today, it would be a 10-episode miniseries and it would be incredible. Like, I would be so down. Like, if you get that, somehow get that cast from like 2002, get like Jim Caviezel and like young Guy Pearce to be just like the sniveling ass. You have like two episodes that are in the present, and then the last eight are about his revenge. I would love that so much.
Yeah. Oh, that was a great, great film. Yeah,
I liked it a lot.
Definitely.
Yeah. But anything you want to touch base on before we wrap up about just the Tenth Kingdom? Any other thoughts you had on it?
My sister wanted to mention her favorite line in the show is "suck an elf," which is a thing that all of the trolls say. There's a lot of fun little words that are just variations of, you know, human things. Not much more to say about the series in general, though. Just if you like what you heard, just check it out. It's all on YouTube and on Netflix, IMDb's streaming.
It's on like a bunch of, like, it's on, because it's on IMDb. I also I watched it on Pluto, so it's on there too. Those are both free services. It's on Hoopla, so if you have a library card that's in an area that supports Hoopla, you can get it on Hoopla without the ads, which is really nice. A lot of ways to watch this that are not cost prohibitive at all, so I would say definitely check it out.
Nothing to your pocketbook, dude. It's fine.
Yeah, because I feel like this is one of those shows that kind of, you know, like, because it's, I think, from that era where, you know, it kind of slipped away, and like, this has kind of been forgotten, but it could definitely use like a revival in terms of popularity. And, you know, I think
some of the actors were like trying to drum up some popularity a few years back. I saw a YouTube channel active from the guy that plays Wolf, Scott Cohen.
That would be interesting. Yeah, I would be, you know. Because I was looking over a lot of these, and of the shows that I had pitched to me, this is the one that I knew absolutely the least about. And so I went into this with like the most just like blank slate. And so that was really fun.
That's awesome. Yeah. I was very curious how, like, because I was watching it again today, and I'm like, will any of this make sense? We'll find out. But yeah, a lot of the stuff came through, though, from like the character development from previous episodes you picked up on. So I think they did a pretty good job.
Yeah, definitely. This is a perfect gateway episode, I think.
Definitely.
Yeah. But with that, I want to say thank you, Brad, for coming on and talking to me about this show. As we kind of mentioned, you have your show. I think you have a couple shows. Why don't you tell everybody where you can find anything about you?
Like you said, I have a couple shows. I have the Album Concept Hour, where we talk about concept albums every week. And then with you, we talked about Hot Fuss, so that's already out there. We also have the Album Concept Hour Side B, where we have been kind of doing a, we've been trying to complete the Sufjan Stevens project, 50 States project that he started and did not finish. And we are almost done with that project. So every other week at our YouTube channel, Flyover State TV, we do a live stream at 7:30 p.m. Central Time. And it's just we put together a really great playlist from the artists from the states we're talking about, and we try to see how Sufjan-esque it gets. Other than that, if you want to see any of my, you know, what I'm doing, I have a Linktree, linktr.ee/flyoverstatepark, and that's got everything from me. So
awesome. Yeah, and that will be in the bio. Anybody who wants to check that out, just go ahead and give that a click, and ahead and check all this stuff out, because I had a blast being on your show last night.
That was
so much fun, man.
That was a good time.
Anytime I have any excuse I have to go talk about the Killers, and this is the first time I've actually recorded it, so that was awesome.
Nice. Yeah. No, it was really, really nice to go back to that one. I absolutely love the Killers too, and you've kind of made me want to go back and listen to more Killers. So you kind of did a gateway episode on me with that, because awesome. I definitely am going to go back, because you said that their newest one's a concept album, Pressure Machine.
Yeah,
and that's my whole fucking deal. So we'll definitely be talking about Pressure Machine at some point in the near future, hopefully with you.
I would love it. Have me back on, because that would be so much fun.
Oh yeah. I can't wait to first of all listen to it, and second of all break it down.
And thank you to everybody for listening. If you guys want to hear any more of my stuff too, I do a couple other podcasts. Like I mentioned, I do the show Underrated, kind of my main podcast, where me and a couple friends talk about films that we think are underrated or underappreciated. And that comes out every other week, and you can listen to that, you know, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, however you're listening to this, you can go ahead and listen to that too. I also do one on Marvel called Infinity Stones and Dragon Bones. I'm all over the place. thank you. But yeah, all those links will be below, so check out my links, check out Brad's links for sure. Until then, I will see you all in another life. Thank you again, Brad.
Thank you.